That's not even 3 months worth of daycare.
Right.
So at least I can laugh about it. Hey, stranger. Fancy seeing you here. I know it's been a minute, but Personal Finance from the Hilltop is back. I forgot how much I enjoy doing these, and today's episode is a good one. We're talking the last-minute tax planning moves, things that you can still do right now before the tax filing deadline to keep more of your hard-earned money. Retirement contributions, HSAs, FSAs, tax credits, fixing mistakes, basically all the good stuff to make sure Uncle Sam isn't getting more than his fair share. To break it all down, I've got my pal Tyler Landis, certified financial planner, on the show. Tyler's been on the show several times, and he's a financial planner based in Kansas City, Missouri, and he runs Tandem Financial Guidance. As always, check the show notes if you want to skip the fluff, but let's be real, that's the best part. And because compliance makes me say it, this podcast is for educational purposes only and not meant to be taken as advice. Now, let's get into it. We're live. All right. Welcome back, everybody.
Hey, Kyle.
And Tyler. We've been away for a while. I think you said we're calling this season two of the podcast. So it's been over a year since I've done one of these and hopping back on the horse. Yeah, took a little break, had a kid in that time. So that's, I guess that's our baby announcement. We've got a 10-month-old now as of yesterday. So,
and you joined the ranks of the girl dads.
Girl dad. Yeah. Yeah. So we had our first girl. So now we don't need long-term care insurance anymore. Now we've got somebody to take care of us when we're old, because God knows my boys won't. But yeah, you're going to have to teach me how to braid hair. So that's not something I know how to do.
I'm pretty bad at it. Yeah, I've got two girls. We call it the dad pony. I can give you a dad pony. I don't know if I can braid it that well. I've tried. Doesn't always lead to the best result.
There's got to be a YouTube video out there for it.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I can braid with time, but not under pressure. It's, hey, we got to get out the door. Gymnastics is starting now. Like, I need my hair back. I don't braid well under pressure. But if you give me half an hour, I can get there.
You can't rush perfection.
That's right.
Yeah. Awesome, man. It's been a while. I'm trying to think. You've been on the podcast several times. We're just chatting about it 3 or 4 times. I'll have to go back and look. But what have you been up to, man? What have you been up to since we last recorded one of these things?
Yeah, no new children in our household, but my girls are now 7 and almost 5. My youngest will be 5 next week or this month. No, next month. Jeez. Around tax time, which is good for our topic today. She was born... Yeah, in 2020. So she'll be 5 this year, kindergartner next year. So we're gearing up for that. Seems like more of the same, more than big changes in our life. But we've got soccer and Girl Scouts. We just wrapped up cookie season. So yeah, things are going well.
We just got some of those Girl Scout cookies. There's like a new chocolate cookie.
The Adventureful.
So it tastes like the Thin Mints without the mint.
Okay. The Adventureful is a chocolate wafer cookie like that. It has a little bit of like caramel flavor as well. Maybe
okay,
a little
caramel's brown, in the middle.
Brownie. Yeah. Yeah. That's okay. A good one. The one that's going away this year is the Toastier, which was one of my favorites. It's like a French toast, cinnamon kind of flavor in the icing, but I guess not popular enough to stick around.
Huh. What was your favorite Girl Scout cookie growing up?
Thin Mints, I think, are by far and away the fan favorite. I think Thin Mints, and depending on where you live, they're called a couple things, either the Caramel Delights or those are, I think it depends on your region and which bakery makes them, but those are, those are, I think, the top two for sure, and definitely at our house.
Yeah.
Those Adventurals are pretty good, though.
Thin Mint, for sure. I remember my mom... we used to have Thin Mints in the freezer because mm-hmm. she'd get those, but
I don't know why everyone does that. I don't know what it is about freezing. I prefer it too, but I don't know. It doesn't, they thaw pretty quickly. It's not changing the, but maybe it's just the experience.
Yeah.
We all do it.
That. And then I'm not a coconut person, but I do the Caramel Delights. So mm-hmm. I'm there with you on those two. Awesome. Yeah. So our boys, since you mentioned your girls, our boys are now 9 and 7. So we ditched the daycare bill just to restart the daycare bill. Maybe we'll get into that here when it comes to tax planning.
Yep.
But yeah, they're doing well, getting ready for baseball. So baseball is kind of a year-round sport for us. So I'm super excited. Oldest is in his second year of kid pitch. So that's been fun. Nice. I'm the pitching coach for his 10U kid pitch team. So
when do they lock into positions? Because like our soccer, they don't have a goalie yet, but I think starting in second or third grade, they do have a dedicated goalie, but I think the girls still rotate positions so that everyone experiences that. But is your son pitching or is he in a certain spot on the field?
You need several pitchers. So they typically carry 12 kids on the team for like league rules. You have to have 12 kids on a team. You can only pitch so many pitches per day and you have to have days in between depending on how many pitches. So it's been interesting, like figuring all that stuff out and strategizing and how your schedule lays out. And then when you do tournaments, so he plays other positions. He's definitely not built for outfield. He can catch, but just the speed getting to the ball, that's not his thing. But he plays third and first and then pitches. He doesn't play so very much first right now. We have 3 lefties on the team. And so baseball wasn't designed for lefties. So it discriminates the lefties. And so typically their only positions are first base and then like right field or some play other areas of the outfield. But yeah, so we have 3, which is unusual. But yeah, he's a good little pitcher. He's been working on it for a while with our instructor. And so he throws a regular fastball, 4-seam fastball. But then he has this knuckle drop pitch that he's been working on with his instructor. And so it's an off-speed pitch that drops. So it has some movement on it. And so it's been fun to kind of see him throw that and get more consistent with it. And
yeah, it's always awesome to see your kids excel and get excited about the things they're learning and able to do. That's just rewarding.
Yeah. But as far as set positions, it just varies. So Harrison, my middle child now, my youngest boy, he is playing 8U, and so they're still machine pitch. And so they have fairly dedicated positions, but they do move them around. At that point, like your pitcher's not pitching, so they're just fielding, so you don't have that aspect of it. And then your catcher, there's not like a ton of plays that are made at home plate. And not to sound cold or anything, I don't know. But like typically you kind of throw a kid in at catcher at that age group, like if you're trying to hide somebody. But then once you get to kid pitch, it goes from being your least important position to your second, if not your most important position, because they're touching the ball every time. And so we're actually trying to make him into a catcher. He's, for his birthday a couple of years ago, he wanted catcher's gear. And so we're like, okay, cool. And we've always been told if your kid can play catcher like decently, like every team's going to want him.
Yeah.
Their teams are going to want him because it's just hard to find like good catchers. And so we're working on that.
But yeah, I hope you're stashing money away in the travel baseball fund because I hear youth sports can be an expensive endeavor. Definitely some financial planning topics around that.
Absolutely. So right now we haven't done too many travel tournaments. Actually, last year, so our one out of town tournament, we went up to Dyersville, Iowa, to the Field of Dreams. So they actually have a tournament up there. And so we drove up there, and there is no good way to get there from here. So because it's on the east central side of the state in Iowa, and you either go up to Des Moines and go straight east over almost to the line and then up, or you go straight up and over. So there's no diagonal across the state. So it was like a 5-hour road trip. We did that like a month after our baby girl, Hattie is her name. So after she was born. But it was pretty cool. We played in some fields around the area. And then like their championship games were played on the Field of Dreams field. We didn't make it for that, but we did get to go to the Field of Dreams. And I got to have a catch with my boys. So that was pretty cool. They were supposed to do like a skills competition at the Field of Dreams field, but we had an 8-hour rain delay. So we were supposed to play our first game on a Saturday at 10 o'clock in the morning. We didn't play our first game until 6 o'clock that night. So it was, yeah, but got to experience the local brewery there. It's pretty good. And then the ice cream shop next door.
It was ice cream and beer.
Yeah. Yeah. Beer flavored ice cream. That probably wouldn't taste that great. But speaking of, we're in Kansas City here. Speaking of food and beverage, what's your favorite Kansas City barbecue joint? Or if you'd like to take a different route on this, what's your favorite cut of barbecue?
No, that's fine. I have to say Burnt Ends, being from Kansas City, that is our major contribution, right? Along with being a historical melting pot of different styles. I think people pigeonhole us into being like, oh, that's the Kansas City barbecue sauce. It's too sweet or whatever, depending on what you're used to. But I don't think we're a sauce town. I think we're the place where, by nature of being a railroad hub, it's where all the cattle were driven. And so we had a whole bunch of different influences melding together and creating something pretty special. Yeah, Burnt Ends are the cut that were maybe originated here. I still call it a KC strip, not a New York strip. So there's that on the steak side. But no, barbecue restaurant I had not been to in a while, but is excellent. I wouldn't say it's my favorite because there's so many, but it's definitely one of them, right? Q39. Over there on the west side, or 39th Street area. I went because it was my 39th birthday, and my wife surprised me. That's where she took me. Pretty good. Pretty good stuff.
I still haven't tried Q39. I've got to get down there sometime and check that out. I like it all. I typically do ribs, baby back ribs, or pulled pork. I don't know. I'm basic, but I like to go to the Fairway market and get ribs that they've already made for me. So I don't have to do the work and just throw them in the oven, heat them up and enjoy. So yeah, as far as barbecue restaurant, I don't know. Is it cliche to say Jack Stack?
No, solid.
It's like I explain that to out of towners as your upscale barbecue. Whereas I don't know. Oh, what is the, how may I help you?
Yeah. Gates.
Yeah. Or that's like your common man barbecue.
Yeah, you've got your Gates, you've got your Arthur Bryant's, you got your LC's, you got your Lawnside, there's so many, right? And I'm on the south side of town, so I'm showing my regional bias down here. But there's even in the North Lake out in Raytown, there was Heart Barbecue. It's doing really well. Yeah, the great places.
So for all you out of towners, when you travel to Kansas City, Tyler just gave you some options of barbecue places to try. So awesome.
Not sponsored. Not yet.
But your shirt's KC Beer Co. I see that. Yeah. That's one of our favorites to go. We've thrown our kids' birthday parties there a couple times in the beer garden. Nice. I think it's more for the adults than the kids, honestly, sure. If I'm being truthful. But they've got that beer garden where the kids just play, hop over in the grass side and play pickup football, throw the baseball around. So parents can just chill. And it's funny because our kids are like, can we go down to KC Beer Co. again? Yeah. We're like, sure, that sounds great. Get a big Bavarian pretzel.
Yeah. Can't go wrong.
Before we dive into our topic, we're going to revive the 5 minutes of fluff. I know it turned into the 15 minutes of fluff, but we're going to stick to the clock here. So I'm going to put us on the clock and we're going to do the 5 minutes of fluff. So we're staying on track here. You ready to go?
I'm ready.
All right. 5 minutes now. So first question, do you file your taxes early, last minute, or an extension every year? And if this is too personal, you can plead the fifth.
You're good. I have never, probably not once, filed my taxes early, but that's not on purpose. That's just the way. I think that's probably, filing early is probably the least common answer to this question, but unless people are really on their stuff. I would say historically, I have been guilty of filing extension because I had to. Because I was not, didn't get it done in time. But now I have been a financial planner for over a decade now. Like I've become more responsible as I've gotten older. So I'd say now if I am filing an extension, it is strategic or on purpose because I need to close out my books from last year or wait for some more information to come in or something like that. Or I'm doing client work and getting clients taken care of first and pushing my own stuff off till later. But I would say last minute, it's probably the right answer to this one for me.
That's my answer too. Last minute. Yeah. I don't think I've ever filed an extension, but yeah, last minute, I typically don't do early. However, for this year, I did get mine done last week. So we're good to go there. But yeah, kind of like you, I always focus on my client's stuff first and then get around to my stuff. Yeah. Second question, is a refund good, bad, or indifferent?
So I would say indifferent, but with some caveats. I think you would like to keep it tight. You'd like to be a few hundred dollars, maybe $1,000 or $2,000 in either direction. I don't worry too much about nailing it. But as long as you're reasonably in the ballpark of what you should have withheld and you're receiving maybe a small refund or owing a little bit, I think that's good enough. You know, that we all hear the traditional standard advice that you're giving the government a loan or whatever. You don't want to have
loan.
Yeah, you'd rather have your money in your pocket throughout the year rather than over withholding for taxes. But I think if you're going to be surprised, you'd rather be surprised with a refund than surprised with owing a whole bunch. So I think keep it tight, but better to avoid surprises if you're not otherwise prepared.
Yeah, I'd say I'm kind of in line with you on this. I'm indifferent. Ideally, we owe nothing, get refunded nothing, only pay what we owe. Don't leave the government a tip, as I think Jarvis and Shalansky say. I think you told me originally when I got into this is ideal target is get your client in within $1,000 on either end is good. We'd call that good. I'm trying to get that a little tighter with some tax planning software that I'm utilizing. A lot of it is there's just a lot of variable pieces depending on the client. One of the big things recently has been with interest rates going up and you're actually earning something on your high yield savings account. We've had clients that have earned a couple extra $1,000 per year in interest, and that's taxable income. And usually you're not withholding tax on it, but I'd say indifferent. One thing you would love to get a tax deduction for, but you can't.
Oh man, I should have thought about this one. I'm trying to think like, what are hobbies, anything that I spend money on that is not deductible? Let's say gardening. Recently, I did a deck project in the backyard, and needed some moves to our garden. And so that's what I've been on right now. But yeah, domestic like farming, there are probably tax deductions at scale for producing food production. So let's say, yeah, if I'm growing food or something, deduct the cost of my like overpriced raised beds that I want to put in because they're very aesthetically pleasing next to my new deck. But that's nice. I don't know. That's my answer.
All right. So we're at our 5 minutes. So I'll make mine quick. The child dependent care deductions.
Oh my.
Using the dependent care FSA, you can do up to $5,000 per calendar year if your employer offers it. And then you also have dependent care tax credits up to $6,000. If you have $3,000 per child, up to $6,000 if you have multiple children.
Yeah.
Anywho, daycare costs a whole hell of a lot more than that. So I wish you could actually deduct the full amount.
That's a way better answer than mine for multiple reasons. Five is laughably low for childcare. And as a deduction, it's not only are we limited to $5,000 and that's too low for everybody, it's also worth more to me who, you know, or worth more to families who earn more because I'm deducting my taxes at a higher rate than people who are maybe, you know, even more crunched by daycare. I feel fortunate that we've been able to make it work and afford daycare, but it's a struggle for every family. And I think there's a lot that could be done to make childcare more affordable, and it benefits the economy as a whole because parents can stay productive and without the money stress.
My kids are going to be paying into your Social Security someday.
Exactly. Without getting like too philosophical about it. Our economy depends upon parents' ability to work and produce and make goods and services in the market. And childcare is a necessity to allow that to happen.
But yeah. Babies are a good thing. So to close this out. So as always, baseball season's coming up. We're almost there. What's your walk-up song right now?
My walk-up song right now, there's two bands that are coming to Kansas City this summer. One has been on hiatus because their lead singer had a solo career for several years, but I didn't get to see them before they broke up. That is Alabama Shakes. Brittany Howard is the lead singer, vocalist. Very excited that this band is back together for the summer, so we're going to go to Starlight and try and see that. And then the other band is Manchester Orchestra. Another favorite of mine is coming to town with Incubus. So that also at Starlight, I believe. So that could be a good show. But those are the bands I'm listening to right now when I need to get some energy while I'm working.
Incubus. Blast from the past. I was on an Incubus kick when I was in high school. So I like a variety of music. Any specific song?
Not really. And if I was being honest, like my walk-up music would be White Noise because that's what I probably listen to the most, either while working, trying to tune everything out or going to sleep. We've got a White Noise machine. So that's probably what I listen to more than anything fun, but that's horrible walk-up music.
I like it. It'd be unique. It'd be unique. So everybody would be like, what? Where's music? Awesome. Oh, so mine right now, I'm just going to throw this out there. It's probably annoying. I don't know. I listen to Taylor Swift music and it's probably, Carmen is my boyfriend. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Has nothing to do with your Chiefs super fandom, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I know it's annoying. You're trying to watch a football game and they always flash to her. And I don't know. Do you think it's going to work for him?
You know what? She didn't ask for that attention. They're just a young couple trying to live their life in love. I have no complaints about all playing out. And as far as I'm concerned, she's an adopted Kansas Cityan at this point.
Yeah. What if she breaks Travis's heart?
She can go back to Philly. Yeah. I don't
know. Yeah. Awesome. All right. So let's dive into our topic. Post year-end tax planning moves, just for compliance purposes. I'm supposed to say this is not advice. This is educational purposes. I'm not a CPA. I'm not an EA. Neither are you. However, you do have some experience filing taxes, right? You still doing tax preparation?
I do a little bit. Yeah,
we're not advertising that here.
No, yeah, I'm not looking for new tax prep clients, but I have prepared returns and do my own and some family members and a handful of clients.
Yeah. So we have some experience with this. We have some knowledge to throw around. A lot of financial planning, which taxes are a big piece of that. It all fits together like a puzzle. They all work together. When you're saving in your retirement accounts, you're getting a tax deduction or you're not paying taxes. And then when you take a withdrawal, it's taxable income or it's tax-free withdrawals. And so there's always tax implications somewhere around there. And so I think what we thought would be a good topic to maybe discusses. So we're past the year end. What are some things we can do from a tax perspective for last year still? So post year end tax planning moves that we can make. If you are a W-2 employee, there's not a ton of options, right? Compared to like maybe a small business owner. But I wanted to highlight a couple of options to maybe think about. And I think the first one to talk about is traditional IRA and Roth IRA contributions. And so even though it's past year end, you can still make a contribution to those for 2024 up until the tax filing deadline. So that's the cool things with those, whereas compared to your employer-sponsored plan, your 401k, 403b, government employees, TSP, those are calendar year. And so something you could look at is making contribution to those. You want to hit on the contribution limits for those for 2024 and maybe talk a little bit about that?
Sure thing. Yeah. A traditional IRA or a Roth IRA can both be good. A pre-tax or traditional IRA is going to save you on taxes now. It grows for you over your working years. And when you withdraw in retirement, you're taxed at your ordinary income rate at that point. Roth IRA is the opposite. You don't get a tax deduction for your contribution today. It still grows for you over time. And because you did pay your taxes on the way in, all of that growth comes out tax-free in retirement. Either one can be a great tax planning measure, whether it saves you taxes today or down the line. Both can be a good thing to do. The contribution limit for 2024, and I believe it's the same for 2025, is $7,000. Mm-hmm. So it's individual. So if you're a married couple filing taxes, this is an individual limit up to $7,000 each. There are some other numbers to be aware of, depending on where your gross income falls for the year, whether you are allowed to deduct a contribution. It phases out at a certain point with your income, and your ability to directly contribute to a Roth IRA also phases out at a slightly higher cap for households. But check those numbers. And if you're finding that your AGI for the year is under those limits, there's still time to make those contributions and take advantage for 2024 and have potentially an impact on this year, on 2024's tax return. So can definitely reduce your taxable income if you're making a contribution to pre-tax, which can either get you a bigger refund or cause you to owe less. Either one of those things would be helpful today or set you up for longer term tax-free growth for retirement.
Yeah. You said 7,000 is the contribution limit per individual. So married couple, assuming you're under the limits, could get 14,000 into Roth IRAs. If you're 50 or older, you get $1,000 catch up. So couple that's over 50 could do up to 16,000 for 2024. I always say
go fill up the prior year before you start on the current year, because you never know what's going to happen this year. But once we get past that tax filing deadline, the box closes and you can't put any more contributions in there for that year. So go fill up the prior year bucket while you're still able before you move on to the current year. Kind of, you mentioned there's income limits to be able to contribute MAGI. So modified adjusted gross income. How do you describe this to people? Because it's not actually on your tax form. It's like all these things are tied to MAGI, your modified adjusted gross income, but it's not actually on your tax form. And so people are like, how do I figure that out? The way I describe it, and see what you think about this, I say, it's not on your tax form. There's a separate worksheet to do to figure it out. But for most people, your MAGI is going to be your AGI. And so look at your AGI, line 11 on your tax return, and see if you're close to the phase out limits. And then if you're close, then we can go do the MAGI calculation to see if you're over or under. But for most people, it's your AGI. There's a few add backs with the MAGI. So what are your thoughts?
I agree. Yeah, 100%. If the phase out range for these contributions is pretty tight, it's a range. I don't have it right in front of me, but it's like a $10,000 range. And if you're beyond it, you can't contribute anymore. If you're below it, you can. And if you're in the middle, it's reduced. So for most folks, your modified AGI is your AGI, unless you specifically have some of those pieces that are going to be added back. And in that case, use the worksheet, find out where you actually fall. But if you're nowhere close to the phase out ranges, then, you know, you're probably fine. And double check before you actually make the contribution. But yeah, for me, AGI, modified AGI as a checkpoint they're not the same, but it's a good check, a good indicator.
Yeah. Just real quick. So Roth IRA contribution limits, the phase out begins in 2024. Remember, we're talking about 2024 right now. So the phase out begins at $146,000 of modified adjusted gross income for single filers. For married filing jointly, the phase out begins at $230,000. You got a pretty big window. On the flip side of that, with the traditional IRA, the deductibility of your contributions, that's an important word to keep in there, deductibility. So the phase out's much lower. So singles, it's modified adjusted gross income of $77,000 is where that phase out starts. And as Tyler said, it's a range of about $10,000 where you're fully phased out. For married filing jointly, it's $123,000. Significantly lower limits on the deductibility. So getting that tax break now, contributing to the traditional IRA. For most folks, I'm always like a Roth IRA person, just because given our tax rates currently and not knowing what future tax rates are going to be, if you're in the eligibility limits, it probably makes sense for you to do the Roth IRA contributions. And the good thing about that is, even if you filed your return, if you're doing the Roth, you don't have to amend your return. So because it doesn't impact your taxes, because you're not getting the deduction, you'll get caught up next year on your tax filing. Whereas if you did the traditional, you'd have to amend your return so you get that deduction. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think by and large, you are never going to regret having already paid your taxes. That's what I tell folks. By the time you reach retirement, no one's going to sit there and think, man, if only I still had to pay taxes on this distribution. So from that perspective, I think if you can afford to make the Roth contribution and pay the taxes today, usually go for it. There are cases that are pretty clear indicators the other direction, but by and large, I'd say the younger you are, the lower your income is relative to where you think it will be in the future. So you're earlier in your career, maybe you're filing single right now, but maybe you get married one day and you're a two-income household and that pushes your marginal rate up. All of those things would indicate that Roth would make sense today. If you find yourself mid-career, two incomes, making more money than you ever have, but you're also good savers and you know you're living within your means, and maybe by the time you retire, you're not going to be pulling out, you know, as much as you're earning today, and so maybe you'll be in a lower tax bracket in retirement, those are the times when maybe you want to take the tax deduction today while you're in a higher bracket. But it's really a teeter-totter or a balancing beam where you want to make sure that you're taking the tax break when you're in the higher rate and it makes the larger impact. The hard thing is projecting out into retirement and thinking about, okay, I'll have Social Security that's partially taxable. I'll have maybe a pension income. Maybe I've got my pre-tax distributions from retirement accounts. if you have rental property, who knows what your income mix is in retirement. And then in your 70s, required minimum distributions, not to get too deep in the weeds, but RMDs potentially push you into a higher tax bracket than maybe you've ever been, just by nature of where you are required to pull income from, whether you spend it or not, you still trigger taxation. So there are reasons why this it matters. I think as a rule of thumb, if you're on the top half of the marginal tax bracket grid, maybe think about pre-tax contributions. If you're on the lower half of the marginal grid, maybe go Roth. And if you're confused, maybe do 50-50 and split the difference and have some good tax diversification down the line.
Yeah. But with the traditional IRA specifically, those limits are so low on the phase outs that you're already going to be in a lower tax bracket anyways.
And yeah, so you're right.
It doesn't really make sense. You're probably in the 12% marginal bracket, you know, if you're eligible for traditional IRA deductibility. And I'm just like, might as well pay the tax now at that low rate. You don't know what you're hedging your bets on the future of what your future picture is going to look like and what tax rates are going to be. And I know some people don't like me saying this, but dollar for dollar, you can essentially get more into a Roth IRA than you can a traditional IRA because you've already paid tax on the money. So you're getting $7,000 in there in each account. They're both going to grow, assuming the same investment, they're both going to grow at the same rate. And then when you take withdrawals in retirement, one's going to get taxed, the other one's not. So yeah. I know you're getting that deduction now, but dollar for dollar, you're getting the same amount in there. But then in the future, one's going to get taxed and the other isn't. That's effectively putting more money in there. So anywho, I think we beat on that quite a little bit. So remember, going back to that traditional IRA, I said deductibility. Now, that's an important word to keep in mind because Roth IRA eligibility, it's whether or not you're eligible to contribute versus with a traditional IRA, it's anyone can contribute to a traditional IRA, but that word deductibility, whether or not your contributions are tax deductible or not. And so that's where those phase out limits come in. And that's why that's important, because that gets us into the secret backdoor Roth IRA, where you can make a non-deductible contribution to a traditional IRA. And then sometime later on down the road, you can actually convert that over to a Roth IRA. And essentially, it's a way to fund a Roth IRA through the back door. We won't dive too deep into that. I know that's compliance.
I have no qualms recommending it to folks. This is an established strategy that lots of people use every year and years, and there's nothing nefarious about it. But if you end up with non-deductible funds in a regular IRA and you convert, do a Roth conversion, which there is no income limit on, you end up with those dollars then in a Roth, which then grows tax-free. So we call it the back door, but I would say this is an established practice at this point. You have to be careful. There are steps to follow, and maybe that would be better for a whole other podcast, but there are ways to fund a Roth IRA, even if you are beyond those phase outs with several gotchas. But yeah, I don't think it's secret because it's fun to be mysterious about it, but it's not looked down upon, I don't think, whatsoever.
Yeah, no, I talk about it with prospect clients, whatever. It's a legit strategy. You Google it, there's a bajillion articles out there. So the government doesn't make it easy for us because there's this thing that you want to avoid, the step doctrine. So it doesn't appear that this was all like one step together. This is getting too deep into the weeds, but as you alluded to, some steps that you want to take to avoid it looking like you contributed to a Roth IRA, but it's totally legit legal thing to do. There's just no definitive court cases on this. So there's some ambiguity. Sorry. I'm running on sleep deprivation. So our daughter's teething. So she's been waking up in the middle of the night, and we're recording this March 11th. So we just had daylight savings time. I guess happy C day, happy COVID day. So I got a push notification USA Today article saying it was like 5 years ago today is when like kind of the day of COVID where everything started shutting down. So it's mind-boggling to think about that it's been 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah. My youngest was born in April. So next month, 5 years.
Yeah, ago, I remember that.
That was a wild time of, am I allowed in the hospital? Who could be in the room? I could, but I wasn't allowed to leave. A lot of precautions, but yeah, it's wild that it's been 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember I was at our old house and I was had, I think it was a Big 12 tournament, was getting ready to start. And I was going to watch K-State play. But I remember they like last minute stopped the Big 12 tournament and then shut down all the tournaments. And it's, whoa, what is happening? So that was the first, like the thing that hit me where I was like, holy crap, what's going on? But yeah, Big 12, by the way, Big 12, Pac-12, Big 10. For higher education, they suck at counting, right? Like they don't have 12, 10 teams in their leagues. There are these like super leagues with 16, 18 teams. I think Mizzou fan, SEC's got it right. Don't pick a number to name your conference.
Exactly. So, well, just to call it out, I think we both our teams beat KU this year, right?
Yeah, they're having a little bit of a rough time. So still better than K-State. But so, yeah. Back on track. Small business owners, I don't think we need to hit on this too hard, but SEP IRA, solo 401k. So that's something that you could talk to your tax professional about. If that's right for you, something you could do post year end for tax planning purposes, but similar to employer sponsored plan 401k or with the SEP, it's similar to your traditional Roth IRAs, but for the business. Simplified employee pension is what that stands for. But yeah, a little bit of work to do with those, but something to consider. So HSA, FSA, let's chat about those.
Yeah. So these are, especially the HSA, if we're talking about post year end tax planning moves, this is still an account like an IRA that you can contribute to after the end of the year before the tax filing deadline. An HSA is a health savings account, not available to everyone, but if you have a qualifying high deductible healthcare plan that you're covered by, a health savings account is an account that you are eligible to make contributions to, either through your payroll while you're working, but even if you haven't, maybe you didn't hit the max, maybe you didn't hit that limit through payroll deductions, you can still cap that off here before tax filing deadline and lower your taxable income for the year.
Yeah. Yeah. God, they make this so confusing. Why can't we just have one tax-free account that we can contribute money to and take out of it, whatever? So yeah, the HSA, so limits for 2024, I don't know if you touched on that. I was drinking my smart water. So it's smart water, so it's supposed to make me smart.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah, contribution limits for an individual were $4,150. For a family, $8,300. Age 55 and older, you can do $1,000 catch up to the HSA. Again, this is for 2024, and it's similar to the IRA, Roth IRA, like you said, where you make those contributions up until the tax filing deadline. You do get a deduction, so you don't want to file your taxes before you make that contribution. You're a tax pro here. But I tell folks, like, yeah, we're talking about a year-end tax strategy, but if you can make those contributions during the year from payroll, the added benefit there is you avoid the FICA tax. And so you save money there on the FICA tax. So 7.65% you could save on making those contributions to the HSA. Another thing, you want to make sure that you don't overfund it. So you want to include any employer match to the HSA. So take the limit and subtract what they match, and that gets you to what you can contribute, because it's not like your 401k where you have the contribution limits and your employer match doesn't count towards that. But yeah, I'm a big fan of those because of the triple tax benefit. So you get the deduction for making the contribution for expenses, qualifying medical expenses. It's tax-free withdrawals. So tax-free money that you're using to pay for those expenses. And then the other thing is, if you don't use it, you get to keep the money. So it's better than the FSA in that regard, where it's use it or lose it. And even if you're not on a high deductible plan anymore, you still have your HSA. You just aren't able to make contributions to it. You can actually invest that money and grow it, similar to like your IRA, Roth IRA. And so it's almost like a mini retirement account, because once you get to age 65, you can start using it for non-qualifying medical expenses, ordinary expenses, without the penalty. You're still going to get taxed on it, but it's a good little way to set money aside. And then if you don't need those funds, use it as like a quasi-retirement account. And they're not subject to required minimum distributions like IRAs are, but there are some kind of end-of-life tax implications. So if you do the HSA, I always advise, hey, if you're able to cash flow the medical expenses, pay it out of pocket and just keep the HSA funds. Keep those receipts And then in the future, you can go back 30 years and reimburse yourself for an expense you paid out of pocket from the HSA if you wanted to. So that's a cool thing about the HSA. Again, why do they got to make it so complicated for us?
A really flexible account to use. It's better than a Roth. It's a better Roth for medical and turns into an IRA at retirement if you use it for non-medical purposes. Really flexible. No, you can decide to use those dollars today or tomorrow for medical if you need to, or reimburse for past expenses, as you mentioned. But yeah, it's the only account that has that three levels of tax incentive where it's deductible contribution, tax deferred growth, and tax free distribution for medical. So yeah, definitely one that's not as used as it should be. And honestly, not used, as you alluded to, the right way. Even if you have one, its best use is as a long-term investment account and really growing those tax free dollars for later.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything you want to touch on FSAs?
The only thing with flex spending accounts is, and I think this is maybe, I don't know if we're going to talk about this with the things you might have missed, but with the FSA, you cannot do a flex spending account and a health saving at the same expenses. So you can't have a healthcare FSA and an HSA. Flex spending account is something you also contribute to. It's also pre-tax money, but you have to use it within the year. Otherwise, those dollars would be forfeited. And there's a grace period and some ways around that, things you can spend it on. But that's the account where everyone's like trying to spend it at the end of the year, trying to make sure they're using those dollars, as opposed to an HSA that stays with you. But the one thing with the FSA that I think people miss sometimes is that there's a separate dependent care that you can use toward childcare expenses, or really the care of any dependent adult or parent or young child alike, up to $5,000 per year. So it's not a lot, it's not enough, but it is a way to set aside pre-tax dollars in an FSA for dependent care. Yeah, there's another tax-free account to use, Kyle. Make it more confusing.
When you say that's not enough, I'm just thinking about it. I'm like, that's not even 3 months worth of daycare.
Right.
So at least I can laugh about it. You might have touched on this. So if you have a HSA, you can still do a dependent care FSA. It's the healthcare FSA that you can't do. So that's something folks get tripped up on. And I know that's more towards maybe like annual enrollment, but something to be aware of. And then if you do have the HSA, there's the limited care FSA where it covers like dental and vision. So non-healthcare, but yeah. Tax credits, deductions you might've missed. One of those for kids that have kids in college, those are education credits. So there's the American Opportunity Tax Credit and Lifetime Learning Credit. The thing with those, there's more benefit with the American Opportunity Tax Credit, making it up to $2,500 in tax credits, $1,500 non-refundable, $1,000 refundable. I think the math equates to like $4,000 worth of expenses for qualifying educational expenses that you'd have to pay out of pocket. To be able to claim that has to be for the first 4 years of schooling. So like your undergraduate. So you'd want to use that first, and then the lifetime learning credit, more flexible, but the tax credit's only up to $2,000. So if you got a kid in college, something you want to make sure that you're not missing out on can be very beneficial. Yeah. Anything to add about that?
No, that's a good overview there. Yeah. If you have education expenses that you've paid or your child's paid, yeah, those are definitely ones not to miss.
I think that's a pretty good summary or pretty good overview of everything last minute. Again, like I said, W-2 employees, there's not a whole lot of tax planning opportunities, especially after year end, that you can do. The big things are the Roth IRA, traditional IRA, backdoor Roth, and then HSA. Those are kind of the big things. And then just when you're doing your taxes, making sure that you're taking advantage of all the credits, like the education tax credits, anything like that. Tyler, what do we do if we owe the IRS?
Run. You mentioned filing an extension at the top. So I want to be clear, that is an extension to file. It is not an extension to pay. You will still accumulate tax penalties if you have under withheld and you do not pay on time. The extension gets you additional time to finalize your filing and actually get it submitted. So if you do think you're going to owe, it's worth it to make a payment at the deadline, even if you haven't filed yet, to make sure that you're not under withheld and accruing penalties. That said, if you're not able to pay right away, whether you're extending your return or not, it's better to set up a payment plan with the IRS. You can do that and have installments made over time. That's another way, if approved, to reduce the impact of any tax penalty for not paying on time if you're getting set up with a tax repayment plan. And it's pretty simple to do. You can request it online and set up those automatic payments to happen. So pretty simple there. But you don't want to find yourself in a position where you owe and haven't paid. There's also penalties for not filing. So definitely either extend your return or file it. And if you can't afford to pay it right away, set up the payment plan. But don't not file just because you owe or don't know what to do, because then you're going to get late filing penalties on top of under withholding penalties.
And those are worse.
Yeah.
Not filing's worse than just underpaying.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So kind of looking ahead, talked about what we can do now, but looking ahead to avoid these things this time next year, what are some things to think about?
I think the one other thing we talked about, I guess, for kind of housekeeping for your this year tax return is making sure that things like a 529 contribution for education savings gets included on your state return. Depending on your state, there's likely a state tax deduction for 529 contributions. Not every state, but I'd say most, more than not. But that's an easy thing that a tax preparer would miss. You're not necessarily getting a tax document that, you know, in a timely fashion that you can give to your tax preparer, but they still need to know that you made that contribution and include that in order to claim that deduction. Just reviewing your tax return, not just when your tax preparer gives it back to you saying, yep, that's good. Make sure that some of that stuff is included and that it's being filed. It's easier to catch early than to have to amend.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, I think preparing for next year, we'd have a whole different set of things to talk about for tax planning going forward. But with tax loss harvesting, changing your withholding and making contributions to your 401k, which does have a year-end deadline compared to the IRAs we talked about today. So there's different things we could talk about there. But the big thing, what it comes down to, is having enough withheld throughout the course of the year for the amount of tax that you owe. And there is a safe harbor amount. It doesn't have to be a mystery how much you need to be withheld, but to avoid under withholding penalties, these amounts. So to avoid under withholding penalties, you either need to withhold at least 90% of your current year liability or 100% of last year's tax liability. And if your household makes enough income, I believe it's around 150.
150, yeah.
Yeah, as a married filing jointly, then it's 110% of last year's withholding amount. So even if you don't know what your income is going to look like this year, and this applies to business owners, definitely income can change, but you can avoid those under withholding penalties by having at least enough withheld compared to based on last year's amounts and meet that safe harbor.
Yeah. And I describe that as kind of like a way of thinking of this is, so your safe harbor to avoid an underpayment penalty, there's two numbers. One's variable, one's fixed, right? So the variable one is 90% of your current year tax bill. Well, that's a variable thing because maybe you get a raise or something during the year, bonus, those sorts of things. So that's why I call it, that's variable. But then you also have your last year's total tax that you paid last year. As you said, depending on where your income fell, it's either 100% of last year's tax bill or 110% if your income's high enough, $150,000 of AGI. So that's two ways to look at that. And so let's say your income's the same or just slightly higher. Most of the time you want to target that 90% of your current year income, 90% of your current year tax, because if you're over the 150, you're paying 110% of what you owed last year and your tax is still similar, right? So you look at overpaying. On the flip side of that, let's say you got a big promotion, income increased significantly, then you can go to that last year's 110%. Most times that gets you into the good ballpark, and that's a fixed number. If I do that, I know I'm good. I still may owe more, but as long as I meet that safe harbor from last year, I know that I'm going to avoid underpayment penalties. So I think the other thing to touch on is withholding versus estimated payments. Withholding, they view that as making those throughout the year, no matter if you, like I told clients in the past, we've done year-end tax projections, hey, you've under withheld, we need to get you up. So on this last couple paychecks, let's boost your withholding. And so we've increased their withholding at year end. So a lot of their tax was paid at year end. But with the way withholdings go, they stretch that out over the year as though those withholdings were done throughout the entirety of the year, versus with the timing of making like estimated payments or making tax payments directly, that's a timing thing. So if we make it at year end, they're viewing it as we made it at year end rather than viewing it as paid throughout the year. And so you could be looking at prior quarters where you under withheld, didn't pay enough tax. And so you could be getting penalized there. So always, if you have the ability to do withholdings to get to your tax, that's a better route to go. So, but yeah, so kind of what I say is run a tax projection, see if you're on the right track. I don't know if there's a good way to do that without software. So that's like something that we do for planning purposes, financial planning. That's a piece of the puzzle. And so one of the things I do with clients is beginning of the year, we do a tax projection. And then towards the end of the year, we tidy up that projection to make sure we're still on track. Maybe they received a bonus or a pay raise during the year that's boosted their income up from what we originally projected. And so tidying that up, I always tell clients, if you get a bonus, pay raise, let me know, and we can update the projections. But we have software that we use to do the projections. But yeah, put together a tax projection, make sure you're on the right track. You can go get tax forms and do that if you want to get to kind of some rough numbers, but know those safe harbor numbers. One of the things for 2024, you can look at 2023's total tax, determine what your safe harbor amount is. Is it 100%, 110%, and see what your withholdings were for this year, and then use that for 2025. What else would you say?
No, that's good. I think, there are definitely more tools in the toolbox before the end of the year to affect that year's tax return. The ones that we've covered today that are available after the fact, I think that's those making any pre-tax or qualified contributions is really the best way to lower taxable income from this year. If you find yourself in a spot where you haven't withheld enough or you're going to owe a big chunk to the IRS, then also making sure that all of your credits and things are in the right place. When you have more time spacing out the withholding, the other thing after age 60, withholding on IRA distributions is also spread across the year. So that's going to be another way to really dial that in. But keeping track of your taxes, your withholding throughout the year, doing some tax projections, or at least being aware. If you had a job change, a promotion, a change in filing status, so you got married or divorced throughout the year, you had a baby, is going to change, you know, what credits you're eligible for and things like that. Things change, life happens, and that does affect our tax returns. Any big life changes is worth taking a closer look and making sure that you're prepared for tax time. Certainly avoiding any penalties, but also having enough set aside if you think you might owe something.
Yeah.
Or adjusting your W-4 if you're going to be taxed less, if your household size grows, for example.
Yeah. You might be withholding enough at work, but outside sources, your work's not accounting for that. And so you may be under withholding, and maybe it's adjusting your W-4 and withholding an extra amount per pay period. And doing a tax projection is the best way to do that. And so there's an advisor out there that's very heavy into tax planning, Debbie Taylor. And she always says on webinars, tax planning is a year-round sport. And take it as that. And I know it's taxes. Ugh, I hate taxes. And I don't do tax preparation, but I help clients do tax planning. So that's proactive tax planning. So it's not last minute and we're, oh God, what do we do? And yeah. And then at the end of the year, there might be some opportunities for things like a Roth conversion or something like that. It's planning to succeed, or what is it? Failing to plan, planning to fail. What's the opposite of that? I don't know. But yeah, awesome. I think that covers it. I think we've got some topics for the future. I'm going to get Tyler roped into doing this podcast together. It's co-hosting Tyler and Kyle. I've already thrown a name out there, Brewing Financial Sense with Tyler and Kyle. See, I'll even let you put your name first. So awesome. So tell everybody where they can find you these days.
Sure. Yeah. Kyle and I are both here in Kansas City. We anchor the city from north to south. So I'm on the south side. So if you're down in the Waldo Brookside area, you can find me probably out and about at a kid's sporting event or otherwise. You can find me online at Tandem Financial Guidance. TandemGuidance.com. That's my firm. And I, like Kyle, do fee-only comprehensive financial planning for folks who want to build wealth over the long term. Yeah, we're around.
Awesome. Yep, I'm flying around the Northland. Rarely leave my home other than to go to baseball games. But yeah, thanks for hopping on the mic with me. It's fun to get back into this, and let's do it again.
Sounds good. Thanks, man.
Well, that was a fun conversation with Tyler. Hopefully you learned a few things you can still do right now to keep more of your money in your pocket this tax season. Check out the show notes for all the links we mentioned. If you want to learn more about me, and let's be honest, who wouldn't, you can visit hilltopfp.com. Make sure you subscribe to Personal Finance from the Hilltop so you don't miss the next episode. And it's coming in hot. And of course, if you leave a 5-star review, your tax refund might magically get bigger. Okay, not really, but I'd appreciate it. And now for the disclaimer, this podcast is for educational purposes only. It's not meant to be specific tax or investment advice. Consult your own professional. Signing off from the Hilltop, I'm Kyle Hill.